Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind. I am your host, Mark Troutman. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. This episode with special guest and tax whiz, Sean Mullaney, was recorded live from Camp Fi in Colorado Springs. We discuss many elements of the new tax bill that was signed into law this past July 4th. Enjoy. Welcome to the Mark's Money Mind Show. We are recording here in front of a live audience at Camp Fi Rocky Mountain Week 3. Let's hear it. And what's interesting is that this is technically week 3, but it's actually session 4. So there was a Camp Fi week 1, a 1.5, which was midweek, 2, and this is week 3. So actually 4 camps. And tonight I have the pleasure of speaking first with Sean Mullaney. Sean is a financial planner based in Los Angeles and the author of the Fi Tax Guy blog. So welcome, Sean.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
So I thought it would be fun to cover, to cover some of the changes that might affect many of us in the OBBBA, which is the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that passed earlier this month. So why don't we just talk about some of the highlight changes, and then maybe we can get into some of the details. Obviously, the tax rates are now, quote, permanent.
That's right. So if we're going to start big picture for everyone in the room, and then we can get more granular for fewer people in the room, tax rates that were in effect from 2017 through this year, 2025, were scheduled to sunset next year. They're going to be now permanent. So in 2026, the brackets that we've had for the last 8 years will be the brackets. And those are the brackets going forward. The term that folks use is permanent. Permanent means they're the law of the land unless and until Congress makes a change. And they are generally helpful, right? We like paying less tax. Now, politically, you could be on one side or the other, and that's fine. But if we're only thinking about financial planning just sort of in a vacuum, obviously, we like paying less tax rather than more tax. The 15% bracket is now permanently 12%. That can help early retirees. 25% is now permanently 22%, and on and on and on. So very helpful for those in the FI community, particularly those living in early retirement.
And then they also changed the standard deduction, and I believe that goes into effect for actually this tax year, correct?
Absolutely correct, Mark. This is the first change that changes something for this year. So tax brackets for this year are the same, no change in the tax brackets. But what did increase is the standard deduction. So first it was made permanent. 2017 very much increased the standard deduction. And it was scheduled to be $15,000 for singles, $30,000 married filing joint in 2025, and then it was going to come down in 2026. What they did is they gave it a little bit of a boost this year, and then next year it'll be inflation adjusted for that boost. So this year now, instead of $15,000 for your singles, it's $15,750 for singles. And for marrieds, instead of $30,000, it'll be $30,100. And this is very helpful for the early retiree.
I just wanted to quickly jump in here and say Sean meant to say $31,500. So I just wanted to make that slight correction.
Think about the profile of most early retirees. Most, maybe not 100%, but most tend not to itemize their deductions. So that means whatever the published standard deduction is, that's their deduction for the year. And living in early retirement when you're either selling assets for capital gains, or maybe you're living off a traditional retirement account, for either one of those, a higher standard deduction is beneficial. So this is certainly beneficial for those in the FI community. The FI community generally benefits from a high standard deduction, considering that in most years, most FI adherents will take the standard deduction.
And then I think there was a slight boost in the child tax credit too. Are you familiar with that? I think it was like $2,000 to $2,200 or something.
Correct, Mark. It went from $2,000 to $2,200. So that's a 10% increase, and every little bit helps. Obviously, that's going to help the accumulators more than early retirees in most cases. But yeah, very beneficial, and it's, you know, per child, so that can start to add up.
And that is for this year as well, I think, or is that going to affect next year?
So I would have to double check that. I believe it is this year.
Yeah, that's what my understanding was. But again, always fact check everything. The other thing is that, and this is for retirees, there's a new personal exemption. They were talking about trying to eliminate tax on Social Security, but they can't really just not tax that, is my understanding, because it goes back into the Social Security pool. So they kind of had a workaround. Are you familiar with that? I think it was $6,000, right?
That's exactly right, Mark. So the idea of no tax on Social Security ran into sort of two issues. One is reconciliation. It's hard to change, or you basically can't change the payroll tax system, the Social Security system, through reconciliation, and this absolutely would have done that. Two, it would have cost a lot of money. So they have this workaround that's a little bit of an opportunity. So the workaround is a $6,000 per senior deduction starting this year. So it starts this year, and it applies if you're age 65 by year end every year. So that's very helpful, because not every retiree is going to take Social Security by age 65. And in fact, this is totally decoupled from whether or not you're taking Social Security. It's decoupled from whether or not you're retired or working. Doesn't matter. Now, of course, if you're working, you might have more income. We'll talk about that in a second. And it's decoupled from whether you itemize or take the standard deduction. Either way, you can claim this deduction. Now, there are two caveats we could talk about. One is an income phase out, and two is a temporary nature. So the income phase out, it's pretty favorable. So for those who are single, at $75,000 of income, it starts to phase out 6 cents on the dollar. So up to $175,000 of modified adjusted gross income, you can get some piece of this. And then for married, it's very favorable. $150,000 is the lower end of the phase out. So if you make $149,000 in retirement as a married couple, you get a full $12,000 deduction. So that's helpful. And it does phase out 6 cents on the dollar to $250,000. So even some very affluent retirees are going to get this.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I look at these phase outs, and a lot of things like the standard deduction is twice as much for married filing joint, but the end phase out for married filing joint is not twice as large as single, because it phases out all the way at 175 for singles, which would theoretically be 350 for married filing joint, but it's 250. But still, like you said, that's a pretty large number.
Well, and I think the way, you know, if you think about a married couple, right, they've got two baskets of retirement accounts. You know, one worked for so many years, the other worked for so many years. And when we're single, it tends to be that we have some portion of those retirement accounts, and it's usually more than 50%. So I think this rule is a lot harsher on singles, because I think you're going to have a lot more single retirees get to that 75 number than married people get to 150. You got to run your own numbers. You do you. There's no guarantees here. Now, there is a temporary nature to this. So it's only for 4 years as written. However, the standard deduction and the lower tax brackets were only for 8 years. They too were temporary. Temporary can absolutely be the way station to permanent. And politically, it's going to be a little interesting, right? We don't know the future election outcomes, of course. But in 2029, this deduction plus a new deduction for some tip income plus a new deduction for some overtime income sunset. They go away, at least as written now. And so there will be some political pressure in the system. Wait a minute. In 2029, do we want to have tax increases on waiters, waitresses, baristas, factory workers, and retirees? The politicians of either or both parties may be adverse to that outcome. No guarantees, of course, in that regard.
I have a couple notes here, and let's jump ahead a little bit to just some of those extra little things. So there was something about a tip exclusion, and I think, wasn't there one other? Oh, like
overtime,
and then also like
auto
interest deduction. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's some, and by the way, when I was first training as an accountant 3 decades ago, they used to talk about deductions for AGI and from AGI. So there are some deductions that are quote unquote for AGI, for adjusted gross income, like self-employment tax deduction. That would be a deduction for determining AGI. And then all the other deductions, those are itemized deductions. So that's from AGI. And then in the recent, in the last decade, now we have these, I'm starting to call them sundry deductions. So it's the qualified business income deduction. It's the TIPS deduction. It's the senior deduction, where they're in this third basket. So they're not, they don't determine AGI. Your AGI doesn't go down because you got a senior deduction. But they're also not itemized deductions. Your itemized deductions don't increase because you get the senior deduction. It's sort of slotted in between. And I think the tax return is actually going to need a new form to capture all these.
I feel sorry for the IRS employees right now.
They're
going
to have to capture all these and then throw them into the form 1040 on page one, presumably. So it's a little, it's getting a little messy.
How much for the postcard, the tax return?
There won't be any postcard tax returns. So for tip income and for some overtime income, there's one of these deductions. So it's still income. It's going to be all reported. It's all still subject to FICA, so to payroll tax. But what the worker is going to be able to do is presumably there'll be some information on their Form W-2 reporting, I got so many tips, or so much of my income was overtime income. And they're going to use that number to then claim an income tax deduction. So it is helpful. You know, if I was a waiter or waitress or a bartender, I'd absolutely be very interested in this tips deduction. If I worked, you know, it's going to be mostly blue collar type workers. It might be some like police and those sorts of workers can get a deduction for some of that overtime income. These are limited. You know, they're absolutely limited. There's some AGI limits that I don't think will apply too often, but absolutely could apply.
Yeah, they're pretty high.
Yeah. But so they could happen. So there's absolutely a lot of these smaller deductions, but could be quite impactful from an income tax perspective if you have the right profile.
And then before we get to charitable contributions, because I think that's an interesting subject, the state and local income deduction.
Yes.
Increase.
So this issue is like pretty much 100% political, right? So you got to remember 2016, the Republicans win with relatively healthy majorities in both houses. And Republicans tend to come from lower tax states. So they didn't like the idea of higher tax states that tend to be more Democratic, charging their residents high property taxes, high income taxes, and then having deductions on federal income tax returns. So to pay for the 2017 bill in part, they said, well, we're going to cap state and local tax deductions for itemized deductions at $10,000 per tax return. Okay, fast forward to the 2024 election. A similar result, but not the same result. The House of Representatives this time is very close. The Republicans have a very slim majority. And part of that slim majority is Republicans from blue states, from California, New York, and New Jersey. There are Republicans from those states in the House. And so they had a lot of leverage in this process in order to barely pass the bill. And so they sort of held out, hey, that $10,000 cap, we don't like that. That's hurting some of our constituents. So the cap has been increased for the next 5 years, including this year, up to about $40,000. There'll be some adjustments upward for essentially inflation for the next 4 years. And this one, now there is an income phase out, but it's a very high level, $500,000. So for most FI adherents, that's not going to be that much of an issue. So the retiree profile, this really helps. Picture a widow in New Jersey paying $25,000 in property taxes in New Jersey on her home. She's now, instead of taking what would be with her, you know, over 65, it'd be about $17,750, quick math there, a standard deduction. Well, now she'll just take itemized deductions because she'll have $25,000 of property taxes. So she's a real winner here. Many people who are still in their careers paying state income tax are winners on this one. And this one's going to be relitigated. So this is temporary. It goes away in 2030. And there'll be another political battle, and you'll have to see what's the composition of the House and Senate to see what its future looks like.
Okay, and then charitable contributions. Before we had to itemize, and during COVID, there was this little like carrot where we could take a charitable deduction without itemizing, but they've in essence expanded that, right?
That's right, Mark. So there's a mini revolution in charitable giving, right? So over most of the last few years, other than the year 2021, which you pointed out, essentially we've had itemized deductions or qualified charitable distributions. And for many most charitable giving has just fallen off the table at tax time. Most people take the standard deduction, so they just don't get any charitable benefit. These qualified charitable distributions are fantastic, but they only start at age 70 and a half. Well, what they're doing with this bill is they're sort of democratizing charitable giving on tax returns. Starting next year, they're saying, if you don't itemize, which is most Americans, you can deduct up to $1,000 of cash charitable contributions per person. So that'd be $2,000 for a married couple. And it's another one, I believe, of these sundry deductions where it's not going to reduce AGI. It's not going to be an itemized deduction. It'll just be slotted sort of in the middle. So that's helpful. And it sort of democratizes. It gives many more Americans some financial benefit for charitable giving. And then there's a something on the other side, on the itemized deduction side. It's a haircut. So what they're going to do is in 2026 going forward, they're going to reduce, if you're itemizing, your charitable contributions are going to be reduced by 0.5% of your adjusted gross income. So that's very interesting. And essentially, it boils down to wealthy people giving large amounts to charity. We want to reduce that deduction a little bit and collect a little more tax.
Do you think it's also because the charitable contribution, $1,000 for single, $2,000, can you still do that if you itemize? And is
you
that a way?
You cannot do that if you itemize.
So it's one or the other.
It's one or the other. Okay. And now, and starting in 26, the other. So I'll give you, let's put some numbers to this. In 2026, say you make $200,000. That's your adjusted gross income. Great. You give $10,000 to charity. All right, so you want to, and maybe you have mortgage interest, higher state and local taxes, so you're itemizing. Well, so what's my deduction? Well, my deduction starts at the $10,000, and then the haircut comes in. Multiply $200,000 times 0.5%. Always dangerous doing math on a podcast, but I believe that's $1,000. So in my little example there, my deduction starting in 2026 is only going to be $9,000, not $10,000. And you could see if you were very high income, at $1 million, the haircut is $10,000, I believe. And so this actually, there's a little planning opportunity for the FI world and beyond the FI world, the donor advised fund. So this is a bunching strategy. Usually you put a bunch of money in 1 year into a donor advised fund. Sometimes you use appreciated securities to do this and you get a big upfront deduction. You contribute out of that for a few years, take the standard deduction in those later years, you're bunching deductions to sort of optimize. Well, if you were thinking about, I might do a donor advised fund in 25, or I might do it next year in 26. My income's roughly the same. I'm sort of indifferent. Well, this moves the needle a little bit to 2025 because, you know, go back to that $200,000 adjusted gross income example. This year, there's no haircut, right? Next year, there's the $1,000 haircut. So if everything else was equal, you might want to do that donor advised fund contribution in 25. Not in 26. We only have 5 months left to do that, but it's just something to think about on the margins.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a good planning opportunity, and that's why I like talking about these tax changes, obviously, when they come out, but also because there's enough time to do some things. I think a lot of people look at their tax situation after January 1st when they don't have as many levers to pull or things that they can do, and that's a perfect example. You know, donor advised fund, you can't do that in January for the prior year.
That's absolutely right. You could do it for that year.
Right.
One other just sundry comment I'll make on this is, to my mind at least, this makes those qualified charitable distributions that much more valuable. So recall, that's when somebody who's 70 and a half or older directs money directly from their traditional IRA to a charity, and the money is excluded from income. It's a great planning technique if you're otherwise charitably inclined. You know, you give $1,000 to your church every month regardless. Great. Do it through a QCD as opposed to doing it through your checking account if you're 70 and a half. Those are not going to be subject to this haircut. So it makes the QCD that much more attractive to my mind because it's a way of giving to charity, getting a tax benefit, and avoiding this new haircut rule.
Yeah, and then for people that are super FI, I guess, the estate gift tax exemption is now, quote, permanent at a big number.
At $15 million next year. So very few people in this room or in most rooms in our great country are going to pay a federal estate or gift tax. Each of us now has a $15 million exemption starting in 2026. and it's adjusted for inflation. If, even for the very affluent, there's something called portability that'll take care of it if you're married. So that's a technique where the first spouse dies, leaves everything to the surviving spouse. The surviving spouse can file an estate tax return. It's not about paying tax at that point. It's about preserving the unused exemption. You know, whatever that is in that year, that goes on to the surviving spouse plus their own exemption. You've got to be very wealthy to die with more than $30 million. I will say for Hawaii and some of our northern states, there's still some state taxes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They tend to be more minor. They tend to be best planned for later in life when sufficiency isn't as big of a concern because you're later in life. But they are out there in some states. They're lower rate, but lower exemptions, generally speaking.
Yeah. And unfortunately, my wife passed a number of years ago, and I did exactly what you said. And I did, it's the estate tax return and got portability for, now it was what the level was at that time. But still, that gets added on to my now $15 million. I should be in the clear.
And Mark, hopefully yours is not $15 million. Hopefully yours is many, many, you know, much, much greater than $15 million. Because if it's $15 million, then that's a very sad year in 2026.
Or I didn't spend enough, I guess, right? So now I really want to get to some of the ACA changes, because I think that really may affect a number of people in our audience. So why don't we kind of run through that a little bit? Because I think there's a lot of changes there, and I have not heard it discussed as much outside of the kind of FI community, and this podcast goes out well beyond the FI
yes.
community. So, yeah.
So, Mark, the bill that passed in July is important in what it did, and it's also important what it did not do. And so what it did not do is make substantive changes to the amount of the so-called premium tax credit. That's an insurance subsidy that's run through the Internal Revenue Code when we're on an ACA medical insurance plan that can be self-employed people, and it absolutely can be early retirees before Medicare enrollment, generally the month you turn age 65. And for the first 7 years, 2014 through 2020, the premium tax credit existed, but at 400%, if your income was 400% of federal poverty level, it went to zero. The dollar above 400% pushed that credit to zero. For 5 years, they've suspended that rule. So from 2021 through 2025, they said, oh, that cliff thing that we had, the subsidy cliff, don't worry about it. Your premium tax credit will just slope down as you go to 410, 450, 500, 550% of federal poverty level in terms of income. And in 2026, it's scheduled to come back. And the one big beautiful bill does nothing to change that. So now that thing is going to come back. I would argue there's about a 1% chance Congress takes action between now and December 31st. It's probably less than 1%. Almost certainly it's not going to happen. So this cliff is going to come back. And the one big beautiful bill, though, does have a planning technique in there that can be helpful in this regard. But absolutely, Mark, we're going back to the premium tax credit environment that existed in 2020 and before, which is all the way back to 2014.
Yeah. And I think what is also not discussed is there was also some benefit to, like, if you were up to 150% or 150 to 200%, you weren't required to pay very much, if anything, towards health insurance. But now those are reverting back to the previous percentages. I'm just looking at a table here. And so the, let's say, 200 to 250% of federal poverty level, which for a single household, federal poverty level in the lower 48 is $15,000. So 2.5 times that number in the current rule. So for 2025, you'd only be required to pay anywhere from 2 to 4% of that towards your health care. And the rest would be subsidy versus a silver plan. But that's going to jump to 6.5% to 8.5% almost. So that's a pretty big change for premium costs for that same class.
Yeah. So I'm going to mention two resources that folks can look at. And I hesitate to do this, but we might as well look at primary sources. So you can Google Section 36, capital B, 36B. And that will have the two tables that you're referring okay. to, Mark. That's the Internal Revenue Code. What's probably going to come up on Google is Cornell Law School's Internal Revenue Code website, a great free resource. And if you scroll through that, through Section 36B, you'll first see the applicable chart from 2014 through 2020, and then 2026 and going forward. You scroll down, you'll see what was that temporary chart from 20, 2021 to 2025, and it shows you sort of the expected amount of income that you're expected to pay for your medical insurance. One comment I'm going to make about that, though, is people got to early retirement in 2020 and before. People got premium tax credits in 2020 and before. So it's not like this is all going away, but it does become a much more challenging planning issue. And techniques around reducing income, and certainly measuring income and reducing income, are going to become so much more important, because getting that income a little lower to get more of a premium tax credit or to go below the 400% level is going to be important for the early retiree and for some, you know, some self-employed as well.
I would think that people that are right on the edge of that 400 are the ones that really need to do their math, because if you go a dollar over, effectively that next dollar, I've seen some estimates, it's like multiple thousands of a percent taxed effectively because the subsidy just evaporated.
One thing about U.S. federal income taxation, for as crazy as it is, it tends to be gradual, right? So another dollar creates a gradual problem. This is a cliff. Now, technically, this is not a tax, but it mostly behaves like a tax. It's a subsidy. It's very interesting. One thing the One Big Beautiful Bill did do is it gave us a little bit of a planning technique that we can add to our toolbox, to other techniques, by the way. It's not the only technique. It allows all ACA bronze plan participants to make deductible HSA contributions. And so especially if you're thinking, I'm going to be right at that 400% poverty level cliff, maybe you want to sign up for a bronze plan, which, by the way, lowers premiums to begin with, putting a little less pressure on this issue. But it also gives you an ability to make a deductible contribution to a health savings account, which maybe could slide you under 400 or could just increase the amount of the premium tax credit. So that could be helpful. And it allows you to have a tax-free pot of money to pay for any medical expenses that might pop up during the year. Because the alternative might be, oh, I've got some capital gain stock I'll sell and then pay for my medical expense. But oh no, that creates taxable income. Or you might be using a traditional IRA and oh, I'll grab some money from that. But oh no, that creates income for this purpose. I'm colloquially referring to this as bronze is gold planning, that for some folks on ACA plans in 2026 and beyond, the bronze plan might be gold because of this HSA opportunity.
And so does that mean that all bronze plans are now HSA eligible? Is that how it works, no matter what the deductibles are?
That's exactly right, Mark. Okay. Prior to this change that's effective for 2026, so that's the open enrollment period starting November 1st, 2025, for 2026 plans and forward, all bronze plans will be high deductible health plans, allowing the HSA contribution. Prior to that, my understanding has been that most bronze plans do not qualify as high deductible health plans. I do know from another podcast, the Two Sides of FI podcast, one of their hosts, Jason, is a California resident, an early retiree, and he's stated that he's on a bronze ACA high deductible health plan. So it exists in the world.
Yeah, but I have one.
Oh, so Mark, yeah, there you go. And we've got at least one audience member with one. All right. Or apparently it's very popular among podcast hosts.
Right.
But,
okay.
But my understanding is that's a minority. And now it's just going to be automatic. You got bronze, you can do an HSA. There are independent HSA providers out there. So you can just go to that provider and say, hey, I'm covered by this. Here's a contribution. You take that on your taxes. That lowers your adjusted gross income. And like I'm saying, it creates this small, you know, small, but still something, a tax-free pool of money to grab for medical expenses so that you don't have to otherwise increase your income because you had a medical expense.
Yeah. So that was a lot of tax stuff, and there's a lot more. How many? It's like 800 and something pages, right?
I believe the bill is 870 pages. Certainly not all of that is tax.
Did you read it all?
I did not read all of it. There's no way. One thing about it, though, you know, it's interesting, in the FI space, we love IRAs, 401ks, Roth IRAs, no changes to Roth IRAs, no changes to traditional IRAs, 401ks. I thought they might change the penalty rules or the rollover rules. No changes to any of that.
Now, Shifting gears a little bit, you've already written one book, which is the Solo 401k, and now you're working on a new one with Cody Garrett. I'd love to talk a little bit about that book, some of the highlights of that. I know it isn't quite out yet. And what's the name of the book? And tell us a little bit about it.
Thank you, Mark. So the book is tentatively titled Tax Planning to and Through Early Retirement. It's written by Cody Garrett, who's a financial planner based in Texas, and myself. And we're hoping to get it out in Q3 or early Q4. So this year, we're really trying to get it out. And it's going to talk about the tax planning. And there's going to be some truth in advertising here. It's to and through early retirement. So we have chapters on accumulators, to use a Bogleheads term. But essentially, all right, you're working. You have an ability to plan for your retirement. What does that look like during the working years? And then we have chapters around, well, okay, at some point you're retiring. And we assume an early retirement model for our book. We define that as before Medicare enrollment. So essentially before age 65. And Cody shared a stat. There's something like 70% of Americans get to retirement before Medicare enrollment. So it's a bit of a niche book for everybody because so many people do early retire. And I'd also argue, even for those who are not thinking about an early retirement, in our volatile economy, you ought to be at least somewhat thinking about it. It ought to be something that you're able to achieve at some point. So it's intended for a broad audience, and we're trying to provide education, and we're trying to provide some tactical and strategic insights. And you know, we talk about premium tax credit. We talk about all the different retirement accounts. We talk about drawdown looks a little different depending on your age, right? There are different rules and different opportunities and different challenges at different ages of early retirement. So we really sort of get granular. Well, in these years, these are the planning considerations. This is what we like. So yeah, it's going to be, we're thinking it's going to land in at around 100,000 words. So it'll be large, but it
won't be. How many pages would that be, you think, about approximately? I guess it depends on the font.
I would say 250 to 300. Wow. So
but maybe not quite as thick as Wade Fowle's retirement planning.
Well, we are trying to offer value for both everyday future early retirees and current early retirees, and for professionals as well. Cody and I were actually having a conversation about, well, you know, who should we, you know, sort of promote the book to, and we both sort of realized in today's content world, the lines between professionals and laymen are blurring, right? You have, it might be Michael Kitsis. It might be the Choosify podcast. It might be Bigger Pockets Money. There's so many different content creators out there. And I'd say almost all of them sort of have laymen in their audience. They have professionals in their audience. So we feel we can effectively speak to both audiences, and we sort of recognize, wait a minute, you know, both audiences are starting to overlap a little bit.
And it can be kind of a resource book too. It doesn't have to be all, you don't have to read the whole thing. You can read the section that may apply to you at that period of time or.
Absolutely, Mark. So okay. What we're, in fact, in the introduction, we were making a point about there is going to be some repetitiveness in this book. And I think that adds two things. One, some of the concepts are a little challenging. So a little repetition isn't the worst thing in the world in terms of educating the reader. But two, we do want this to be a reference book so that some of our readers can say, you know, I read this thing a year or two ago, and I know they speak about this issue. You can go back to a chapter and find the issue and the things leading into that issue, the context. So there is going to be some repetition, but we absolutely intend for this to be a bit of a reference book for folks.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Is there a way for anyone to go to a website or sign up for information about it or anything like that?
So absolutely. I can send you a link.
Okay. And I'll make sure to get the right.
There's a URL that Cody's set up where what you can do is you just enter your name, your email address, and you will get an email from us essentially announcing its launch date. It should be available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and we're hoping to be on a few other podcasts. And Cody is particularly active on social media, but I'm on social media as well. My hope is the audience will be finding out about us and this book in numerous ways, but you can absolutely follow Cody Garrett, CFP, or I'm Sean Mullaney. You can follow either one of us on LinkedIn. We're both on X. I've got a little YouTube channel that will certainly be announcing it. You can sign up for the notification through Cody's little link there. But yeah, we'll be promoting it.
And what is the best way for people to reach out to you if they'd like to?
Yeah, so folks can reach out to me. I've got my blog, FiTaxGuy.com. I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm also on YouTube. You just go type in Sean Mullaney videos, and my videos that usually publish once a week on Saturday mornings, you can grab my personal finance content videos up on YouTube.
Well, every conversation we have, I learn something new every time. I love having you on the podcast. I think it was a year ago that you were here on this show, and I really appreciate you coming on here. So let's hear it for Sean.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people to find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next time on the Mark's Money Mind Show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. Now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only, and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.